Hey everyone, welcome. Today is August 20th, and we are in the waxing phase of the blue moon of August. So it was new just a few days ago, and it will be full on the 31st. So a beautiful blue moon to round out this month. And as you remember, we started with the full sturgeon moon on the 1st. So it's a beautiful bookend for August to have it begin and end with a gorgeous full moon. I hope you're doing well. I hope that you have had time to enjoy the Baba Yaga material that we were so deeply immersed in July. Seems like there's a good response to it when I'm looking through the analytics. And again, I just thank you all so much. The podcast is really gathering a life of its own, and that's so joyful for me. It's really joyful for me to experience that, and I feel a rapport with you every time I sit behind the mic. And so thank you for, you know, sharing in this whole journey with me. And again, I'm learning as I go, too. There's so much I'm learning, and particularly in this last year, and then really intensely in this last 2 months. There's such a quickening happening, and I know that's not unique to me. I know a lot of us are feeling that and responding to that and surrendering to that. So to the extent that is happening in your life, I'm right there with you, and I hope what we cover on the podcast helps in some way, you know, helps you frame and look at the broader picture, perhaps through another perspective that is supportive of your heart and your imagination. Because the further I go into any of this material, which is really just introducing us to our own divinity, what I'm finding is the heart and the imagination are the reliable compass. They are the most trustworthy allies. And of course, being embodied as well. Being embodied, it's just that sometimes the body can be a little bit tricky in that it is also not who we ultimately are, you know. And so there's a dance we do with the body that it's a precious home for us while we are here. And certainly the sensory experience is a gateway and a way of grounding to experience our authenticity. It can also be deceiving sometimes. So, of course, body work and grounding, I think, is really high on the list. But the heart, the soul, the imagination are even more trustworthy. So all of those things together, I think that's how I would say that today. Each day brings, it seems, you know, a shift in perspective, you know, just these nuances and pivots. But I think that feels pretty reliable right now in my walk. So I hope, again, you're doing really well. And today I want to read this incredible chapter, chapter 6 from Autobiography of a Yogi, which I mentioned last time. And again, this is widely available in the public domain. It is the autobiography of Paramahansa Yogananda, and it was one of the first texts to bring sort of the Hindu Eastern mystical philosophy to the West. And that happened in 1946 when this was published, and he died a few years after that, early 50s. He passed, and I am not an Eastern mystic professional in any way, but I like bringing all of these perspectives, at least introducing them and seeing the resonance among all the traditions that we tend to explore here, whether it's C.G. Jung, depth psychologically based, which if you think back to our work with Peter Kingsley's texts, you know, he really offered the perspective that C.G. Jung was offering this Western mysticism, if you will, a sort of a Western prophetic tradition that we tend to borrow from other places. So anyway, there's a lot of overlap and a lot of resonance among these mystical traditions, I tend not to look at quote-unquote religious texts as much. I tend to go more towards the mystical because I feel like they have more commonality among their counterparts wherever they're derived from. So I tend to gravitate towards those. But this autobiography of a yogi has made a huge splash in our culture. So many famous people, whether it was Steve Jobs or even Elvis Presley, not that that lends any more credence to it, but it just shows how culturally impactful this text has been. And it's certainly part of our collective imagination, for sure, our collective consciousness. So where I usually start off with a poem after we orient ourselves with the season and the moon, I'm going to save the poem till the end today because I think it flows nicely and it will be a beautiful ending for where I want to go in the material today. So I haven't forgotten. We'll just pick that up at the end. And I want to begin with this chapter because I think it ties really beautifully with all that we've been about in the podcast for so long now, with our Transurfing Reality material and our exploration of the four levels of consciousness. Again, the first one being to-me consciousness or victim consciousness, by-me or like work ethic psychology consciousness, through-me, the mystical or peak experience that is a state of grace that we don't necessarily know how to reliably reproduce. And then the fourth being as-me consciousness, where we are really entering unity consciousness, realizing our divinity and everybody else's divinity, and interfacing with the external world only from that perspective. So I feel that what we'll talk about today all weaves in beautifully with all of that material. So it's just another window in to help us experience, because I really feel that level four consciousness is 100% experiential. We have to leave our books and ideas behind, but it helps to have these guideposts, if you will, leading us there. And it takes a lot of courage, and yet it's the most natural thing in the world to the authentic self to surrender in to level four awareness. And it's so exhilarating, even though on the material level, sometimes it can be really demanding. And that has been my experience this summer. I've had some enormously demanding external circumstances. We've talked about that together, not in detail, but in terms of like Lenka Lutanska's alchemical point. We've talked about that and what's happening when we are moving more deeply into this material, and it will appear as though everything is going in the opposite direction or falling apart externally. And that is part of leaving levels 1, 2, and 3 behind. Not because they're bad, but because we're all, from this perspective, yearning for our ultimate home, which is living a beautiful embodied life here on the earth, but from that space of divinity where we're meeting ourselves in all of the forms that we're enjoying. So that reference point really demands a quiet mind. And the practices that we have talked about that help us cultivate that are enormously helpful to that end. And I've had great opportunity this summer to get really still with a lot of turbulence externally. And not yay me, because this is available to all of us, but I have been able to hold steady with that, you know, be authentic with some feelings here and there. But most of my summer has been deeply joyful. And that is shocking to me, because externally, It hasn't appeared that way at all. But I'm trusting something magnificent that is revealing itself. And the fact that I have been able to not be pummeled around by the external is such an important part of initiation into this level four awareness. And so on the one level, I'm like, holy shit. And on another, I'm like, I feel like I am being bestowed with the greatest gift ever. And it's extraordinary, and it belongs to all of us. And so I have to thank any of the participants in the external drama because they're doing their part perfectly, or situations are unfolding perfectly to drive me with as open a heart as possible to this space where I'm initiating into this level four more profoundly by the day. And it's a very humbling and exhilarating thing all at the same time. So this chapter six is kind of like a really fun story version of this journey as well. So here we go. I'm going to read straight from the text. Chapter six, the Tiger Swami. And Swami means like guru or teacher in the Eastern tradition. I have discovered the Tiger Swami's address. Let us visit him tomorrow. This welcome suggestion came from Chandi, one of my high school friends. I was eager to meet the saint who, in his pre-monastic life, had caught and fought tigers with his naked hands. A boyish enthusiasm over such remarkable feats was strong within me. The next day dawned wintry cold, but Chandi and I sallied forth gaily. After much vain hunting in Bhawanipur, outside Calcutta, we arrived at the right house. The door held two iron rings, which I sounded piercingly. Notwithstanding the clamor, a servant approached with leisurely gait. His ironical smile implied that visitors, despite their noise, were powerless to disturb the calmness of a saint's home. Feeling the silent rebuke, my companion and I were thankful to be invited into the parlor. Our long wait there caused uncomfortable misgivings. India's unwritten law for the truth seeker is patience. A master may purposely make a test of one's eagerness to meet him. This psychological ruse is freely employed in the West by doctors and dentists. Finally, summoned by the servant, Chandi and I entered a sleeping apartment. The famous Sohong Swami was seated on his bed. The sight of his tremendous body affected us strangely. With bulging eyes, we stood speechless. We had never before seen such a chest or such football-like biceps. On an immense neck, the Swami's fierce yet calm face was adorned with flowing locks, beard, and mustache. A hint of dove-like and tiger-like qualities shone in his dark eyes. He was unclothed, save for a tiger skin around his muscular waist. Finding our voices, my friend and I greeted the monk, expressing our admiration for his prowess in the extraordinary feline arena. Will you not tell us, please, how it is possible to subdue with bare fists the most ferocious of jungle beasts, the royal Bengals? My sons, it is nothing to me to fight tigers. I could do it today if necessary. He gave a childlike laugh. You look upon tigers as tigers. I know them as pussycats. Swamiji, I think I could impress my subconsciousness with the thought that tigers are pussycats, but could I make tigers believe it? Of course, strength is also necessary. One cannot expect victory from a baby who imagines a tiger to be a house cat. Powerful hands are my sufficient weapon. He asked us to follow him to the patio, where he struck the edge of a wall. A brick crashed to the floor. The sky peered boldly through the gaping lost tooth of the wall. I fairly staggered in astonishment. He who can remove mortared bricks from a solid wall with one blow, I thought, must surely be able to displace the teeth of tigers. A number of men have physical power such as mine, but still lack in cool confidence. Those who are bodily but not mentally stalwart may find themselves fainting at mere sight of a wild beast bounding freely in the jungle. The tiger in its natural ferocity and habitat is vastly different from the opium-fed circus animal. Many a man with Herculean strength has nonetheless been terrorized into abject helplessness before the onslaught of a royal Bengal. Thus, the tiger has converted the man, in his own mind, to a state as nerveless as the pussycat's. It is possible for a man owning a fairly strong body and an immensely strong determination to turn the tables on the tiger and force it to a conviction of pussycat defenselessness. How often I have done just that. I was quite willing to believe that the titan before me was able to perform the tiger-pussycat metamorphosis. He seemed in a didactic mood. Chandi and I listened respectfully. Mind is the wielder of muscle. The force of a hammer blow depends on the energy applied. The power expressed by a man's bodily instrument depends on his aggressive will and courage. The body is literally manufactured and sustained by mind. Through pressure of instincts from past lives, strengths or weaknesses percolate gradually into human consciousness. They express as habits, which in turn ossify into a desirable or an undesirable body. Outward frailty has mental origin. In a vicious circle, the habit-bound body thwarts the mind. If the master allows himself to be commanded by a servant, the latter becomes autocratic. The mind is similarly enslaved by submitting to bodily dictation. At our entreaty, the impressive Swami consented to tell us something of his own life. My earliest ambition was to fight tigers. My will was mighty, but my body was feeble. An ejaculation of surprise broke from me. It appeared incredible that this man, now with Atlantean shoulders fit to bear, could ever have known weakness. It was by indomitable persistency in thoughts of health and strength that I overcame my handicap. I have every reason to extol the compelling mental vigor which I found to be the real subduer of Royal Bengals. Do you think, revered Swami, that I could ever fight tigers? This was the first and the last time that the bizarre ambition ever visited my mind. Yes, he was smiling, but there are many kinds of tigers. Some roam in jungles of human desires. No spiritual benefit accrues by knocking beasts unconscious. Rather, be victor over the inner prowlers. May we hear, sir, how you changed from a tamer of wild tigers to a tamer of wild passions? The tiger Swami fell into silence. Remoteness came into his gaze, summoning visions of bygone years. I discerned his slight mental struggle to decide whether to grant my request. Finally, he smiled in acquiescence. When my fame reached a zenith, it brought the intoxication of pride. I decided not only to fight tigers, but to display them in various tricks. My ambition was to force savage beasts to behave like domesticated ones. I began to perform my feats publicly with gratifying success. One evening, my father entered my room in pensive mood. "Son, I have words of warning. I would save you from coming ills produced by the grinding wheels of cause and effect." "Are you a fatalist, father? Should superstition be allowed to discolor the powerful waters or my activities?" "I am no fatalist, son, but I believe in the just law of retribution as taught in the Holy Scriptures. There is resentment against you in the jungle family. Sometime it may act to your cost." "Father, you astonish me. You well know what tigers are, beautiful but merciless. Even immediately after an enormous meal of some hapless creature, a tiger is fired with fresh lust at sight of new prey. It may be a joyous gazelle frisking over the jungle grass. Capturing it and biting an opening in the soft throat, the malevolent beast tastes only a little of the mutely crying blood and goes its wanton way. Tigers are the most contemptible of the jungle breed. Who knows, my blows may inject some slight sanity or consideration into their thick heads. I am headmaster in a forest finishing school to teach them gentle manners. Please, father, think of me as tiger tamer and never as tiger killer. How could my good actions bring ill upon me? I beg you not to impose any command that I change my way of life." Chandi and I were all attention, understanding the past dilemma. In India, a child does not lightly disobey his parents' wishes. In stoic silence, father listened to my explanation. He followed it with a disclosure which he uttered gravely. "Son, you compel me to relate an ominous prediction from the lips of a saint. He approached me yesterday as I sat on the veranda in my daily meditation. Dear friend, I come with a message for your belligerent son. Let him cease his savage activities. Otherwise, his next tiger encounter shall result in his severe wounds, followed by 6 months of deathly sickness. He shall then forsake his former ways and become a monk." This tale did not impress me. I considered that father had been the credulous victim of a deluded fanatic. The Tiger Swami made this confession with an impatient gesture, as though at some stupidity. Grimly silent for a long time, he seemed oblivious of our presence. When he took up the dangling thread of his narrative, it was suddenly with subdued voice. Not long after Father's warning, I visited the capital city of Cooch Behar. The picturesque territory was new to me, and I expected a restful change. As usual everywhere, a curious crowd followed me on the streets. I would catch bits of whispered comments. This is the man who fights wild tigers. Has he legs or tree trunks? Look at his face. He must be an incarnation of the King of Tigers himself. You know how village urchins function like final editions of a newspaper? With what speed do the even later speech bulletins of the women circulate from house to house? Within a few hours, the whole city was in a state of excitement over my presence. I was relaxing quietly in the evening when I heard the hoofbeats of galloping horses. They stopped in front of my dwelling place. In came a number of tall, turbaned policemen. I was taken aback. All things are possible unto these creatures of human law, I thought. I wonder if they are going to take me to task about matters unknown to me. But the officers bowed with unwonted courtesy. Honorable sir, we are sent to welcome you on behalf of the Prince of Cooch Behar. He is pleased to invite you to his palace tomorrow morning. I speculated a while on the prospect. For some obscure reason, I felt sharp regret at this interruption in my quiet trip. But the suppliant manner of the policeman moved me. I agreed to go. I was bewildered the next day to be obsequiously escorted from my door into a magnificent coach drawn by four horses. A servant held an ornate umbrella to protect me from the scorching sunlight. I enjoyed the pleasant ride through the city and its woodland outskirts. The royal scion himself was at the palace door to welcome me. He proffered his own gold-brocaded seat, smilingly placing himself in a chair of simpler design. All this politeness is certainly going to cost me something, I thought, in mounting astonishment. The prince's motive emerged after a few casual remarks. My son is filled with the rumor that you can fight wild tigers with nothing more than your naked hands. Is this a fact? It is quite true. I can scarcely believe it. You are a Calcutta Bengali, nurtured on the white rice of city folk. Be frank, please. Have you not been fighting only spineless, opium-fed animals? His voice was loud and sarcastic, tinged with provincial accent. I vouchsafed no reply to his insulting question. I challenge you to fight my newly caught tiger, Raja Begum. If you can successfully resist him, bind him with a chain, and leave his cage in a conscious state, you shall have this royal bangle. Several thousand rupees and many other gifts shall also be bestowed. If you refuse to meet him in combat, I shall blazon your name throughout the state as an impostor. His insolent words struck me like a volley of bullets. I shot an angry acceptance. Half risen from the chair in his excitement, the prince sat back down with a sadistic smile. I was reminded of the Roman emperors who delighted in setting Christians in bestial arenas. The match will be set for a week hence. I regret that I cannot give you permission to view the tiger in advance. Whether the prince feared I might seek to hypnotize the beast or secretly feed him opium, I know not. I left the palace, noting with amusement that the royal umbrella and panoplied coach were now missing. The following week, I methodically prepared my mind and body for the coming ordeal. Through my servant, I learned of fantastic tales. The saint's direful prediction to my father had somehow got abroad, enlarging as it ran. Many simple villagers believed that an evil spirit, cursed by the gods, had reincarnated as a tiger, which took various demoniac forms at night, but remained a striped animal during the day. This demon tiger was supposed to be the one sent to humble me. Another imaginative version was that animal prayers to Tiger Heaven had achieved a response in the shape of Raja Begum. He was to be the instrument to punish me, the audacious biped, so insulting to the entire tiger species. A furless, fangless man daring to challenge a claw-armed, sturdy-limbed tiger. The concentrated venom of all humiliated tigers, the villagers declared, had gathered momentum sufficient to operate hidden laws and bring about the fall of the proud tiger tamer. My servant further apprised me that the prince was in his element as manager of the bout between man and beast. He had supervised the erection of a stormproof pavilion designed to accommodate thousands. Its center held Raja Begum in an enormous iron cage, surrounded by an outer safety room. The captive emitted a ceaseless series of blood-curdling roars. He was fed sparingly to kindle a wrathful appetite. Perhaps the prince expected me to be the meal of reward. Crowds from the city and suburbs bought tickets eagerly in response to the beat of drums announcing the unique contest. The day of battle saw hundreds turned away for lack of seats. Many men broke through the tent openings or crowded any space below the galleries. As the Tiger Swami story approached a climax, my excitement mounted with it. Chandi also was raptly mute. Amidst piercing and sound explosions from Raja Bangam and the hubbub of the somewhat terrified crowd, I quietly made my appearance. Scantily clad around the waist, I was otherwise unprotected by clothing. I opened the bolt of the door of the safety room and calmly locked it behind me. The tiger sensed blood. Leaping with a thunderous crash on his bars, he sent forth a fearsome welcome. The audience was hushed with pitiful fear. I seemed a meek lamb before the raging beast. In a trice, I was within the cage. But as I slammed the door, Raja Bangam was headlong upon me. My right hand was desperately torn. Human blood, the greatest treat a tiger can know, fell in appalling streams. The prophecy of the saint seemed about to be fulfilled. I rallied instantly from the shock of the first serious injury I had ever received. Banishing the sight of my gory fingers by thrusting them beneath my waistcloth, I swung my left arm in a bone-cracking blow. The beast reeled back, swirled around the rear of the cage, and sprang forward convulsively. My famous fistic punishment rained on his head. But Raja Bangam's taste of blood had acted like the maddening first sip of wine to a dipsomaniac long deprived. Punctured by deafening roar, the brute's assault grew in fury. My inadequate defense of only one hand left me vulnerable before claws and fangs, but I dealt out dazing retribution. Mutually ensanguined, we struggled as to the death. The cage was pandemonium as the blood splashed in all directions and blasts of pain and lethal lust came from the bestial throat. "Shoot him! Kill the tiger!" shrieks arose from the audience. So fast did man and beast move that a guard's bullet went amiss. I mustered all my will force, bellowed fiercely, and landed a final concussive blow. The tiger collapsed and lay quietly. "Like a pussycat," I interjected. The Swami laughed in hearty appreciation, then continued the engrossing tale. Raja Bangam was vanquished at last. His royal pride was further humbled. With my lacerated hands, I audaciously forced open his jaws. For a dramatic moment, I held my head within the yawning death trap. I looked around for a chain, pulling one from a pile on the floor. I bound the tiger by his neck to the cage bars. In triumph, I moved toward the door. But that fiend incarnate, Raja Bangam, had stamina worthy of his supposed demonic origin. With an incredible lunge, he snapped the chain and leaped on my back. My shoulder fast in his jaws, I fell violently. But in a trice, I had him pinned beneath me. Under merciless blows, the treacherous animal sank into semi-consciousness. This time, I secured him more carefully. Slowly, I left the cage. I found myself in a new uproar, this time one of delight. The crowd's cheer broke as though from a single gigantic throat. Disastrously mauled, I had yet fulfilled the three conditions of the fight, stunning the tiger, binding him with a chain, and leaving him without requiring assistance from myself. In addition, I had so drastically injured and frightened the aggressive beast that he had been content to overlook the opportune prize of my head in his mouth. After my wounds were treated, I was honored and garlanded. Hundreds of gold pieces showered at my feet. The whole city entered a holiday period. Endless discussions were heard on all sides about my victory over one of the largest and most savage tigers ever seen. Raja Bangam was presented to me as promised, but I felt no elation. A spiritual change had entered my heart. It seemed that with my final exit from the cage, I had also closed the door on my worldly ambitions. A woeful period followed. For 6 months, I lay near death from blood poisoning. As soon as I was well enough to leave Cooch Behar, I returned to my native town. I know now that my teacher is the holy man who gave the wise warning. I humbly made this confession to my father. Oh, if I could only find him! My longing was sincere, for one day the saint arrived, unheralded. "Enough of tiger taming," he spoke with calm assurance. "Come with me. I will teach you to subdue the beasts of ignorance roaming in jungles of the human mind. You are used to an audience. Let it be a galaxy of angels, entertained by your thrilling mastery of yoga." I was initiated into the spiritual path by my saintly guru. He opened my soul doors, rusty and resistant with long disuse. Hand in hand, we soon set out for my training in the Himalayas. Chandi and I bowed at the Swami's feet, grateful for his vivid outline of a life truly cyclonic. I felt amply repaid for the long probationary wait in the cold parlor. So this concludes chapter 6, and so much comes up for me in this. I mean, of course, it's amazing story. It's amazing storytelling. And I can't imagine, you know, that these sorts of things actually happen. But it really draws an immediate parallel to me among those four levels of consciousness, because there's a lot of success, external worldly success, at level 2, where it's by me consciousness, where it's that work ethic, or, you know, learning a skill set, or reading books, or having a scholarly discipline, you know, any of the above, or a combination of that. There's a lot of worldly success, but there will come a time, and I have lived this, where that ceases to work, where it ceases to work and be effective. And just reinventing the wheel, or finding another job, or finding another partner, or finding another whatever, exercise routine, you know, diet, way to make money, side hustle, will cease to materialize into anything, because we are meant to go to level 4. I often skip level 3 now because, although it's important, you know, it's sort of not at our, it's sort of a gift bestowed on us. So, you know, that level 3 of a peak experience is just sort of whetting our appetite for what is available beyond identifying with the external realm. And it's beautiful. And I'm so deeply grateful for all of the mystical and peak moments of my life, because it gives us a taste of who we actually are. But in that journey from level 2 to level 4, you know, it can feel like a wasteland, and it can be exceedingly challenging to not react to the external, but yet thrilling. I just really have to emphasize that. Focus is required, but while doing that discipline, we are accessing something so enormously powerful, as if for the first time, within ourselves, and the love that is there, the power that is there, the creativity, the way of seeing people and situations, the flood of goodwill, the peace is so extraordinary there. And I'm just getting to know it. You know, I'm just getting to know it. I feel like I've just lifted the veil in this area, and I'm a goner for it. That is where my heart lies now. And I still very much embrace having beautiful, beautiful experiences in the external world. I am not called to the monastic life. You know, I want to have this reflected in my thriving business and in a beautiful marriage with my husband, and all of the above, all of these beautiful things. You know, a very vibrant body that is full of health and grace, all of these things. But it's coming from a different point of origin in level 4. And that's the beauty of this story, that as incredible as this Tiger Swami is, I mean, clearly he had wild success in something that's so instinctual to the external life. I mean, you know, the taming of a wild animal, or at least the subduing of a wild animal. I mean, that's peak skill. But there is so much more beyond that. And clearly he had met his moment where it's like, number two, level two is not going to work anymore. It is time for you to move on to level four. And the tigers of the mind, the tigers of the mind have been my dojo of this summer. I've had many of them, and they've been somewhat fierce. The appearance of things and my commitment to seeing that as illusion while I center and merge with unity consciousness, like we talked about in part three of the Baba Yaga story, that deep mystery where we are releasing form in a very different way than we used to in level two. In level two, when you release the form of something, it usually refers to, I have to let this external situation go, or this person go, or this business go, because, you know, my objectives are not going to be met with them. It's an external emphasis. In level four, as we tame those tigers of the mind through all the practices we've talked about and others, you know, there are many ways to do this. But as that quieting ensues, a whole gateway opens up to seeing life and people and situations and relationships and businesses and external circumstances so very, very differently. And what I'm discovering is, quote unquote, releasing the form from unity consciousness means entering that place that Neville Goddard so beautifully talks about, and we've talked about a lot here together, where your precious desire of the heart, enacted through the imagination, will speak to the God unity consciousness, the goddess unity consciousness in another person, in another relationship, in another situation presenting itself externally. And releasing the form at level four is allowing and invoking that divinity to move through that. But you can't flinch. Just like with the tiger external, you know, chaos that ensued here, we must learn to do that with our own minds and not be seduced by what's going on externally, and to stay true and to stay consistent to what we're discovering to be our true identity, and knowing that that applies to every form, every relationship, every person that we meet, every single one. That is releasing the form to its divinity in level four. So it's a very, very different set and orientation there. And it brings with it such a beauty of falling in love with the divine and falling in love with wealth in terms of a universal perspective of it, and health and vibrancy. You're falling in love with that from source, and you're releasing the forms, however they're appearing, to reflect you meeting yourself, you meeting the divine in all of those forms. I know it's a bit tricky to say, but in my experience, and particularly my experience in my life this summer, the taming the tigers of the mind is about that work. And, you know, even the biblical story of Daniel in the lion's den, if you're familiar with that parable, you know, having yourself fed to lions, and the image there is Daniel just looking at the light through the window, you know, looking upon the face of the divine and ignoring the lions that were sent to eat him. And he was spared because he ceased to identify with the external, knowing his true identity, knowing that that power could then flow through him into the situation that he found himself in. I can't imagine a situation much worse than being in a lion's den. And so the courage and the love, because it does come from the heart. This, we can do so much to quiet our minds, but then we have to drop into the heart, because that's the courage that's going to get us over the line to allow that peace that passes understanding, that courage, that beauty, that joy to flood into our entire life. And it's such a honor to be working in that space. So I love this beautiful story that I think mirrors a lot of what we're talking about so well. And I wanted to say that, you know, we've talked about the anima and the animus before, and those are archetypes of the masculine and the feminine. And, you know, take those out of context with gender identity. It's the power of being versus the external power of doing, that sort of dichotomy. And in the external world, we deal with duality. But C.G. Jung is very famous for saying that the closest archetype to life herself is the anima. And that's not because women are more important than men. Again, we all have both masculine and feminine within us. That is not anything to do with gender. Having said that, the feminine principle of being, of receptivity, of infinite value just because she is the closest archetype to life itself, to the divine, to the essential self, from a Jungian depth psychological perspective. And that really rings true for me. And for me, level 4 consciousness is shifting from the external, which could be perceived as a masculine orientation, to the feminine. And the feminine is fierce when she needs to be. It is not that is, you know, something to be trifled with in any way, but we're talking about power versus external strength. External strength in the masculine, power in the feminine. And again, we all have both of these within us, you know, and then when we, you know, merge with our divinity, it's beyond gender at all, or excuse me, beyond masculine and feminine expression at all. But the ability to quiet the spirit and know that that quality of heart and imagination is the way of deeply honoring the feminine in my view right now, and increasingly in my experience. This is how we actually release our dreams and the external experience of a beautiful masculine and feminine into life. It must be rooted in that heart and imaginal space of the divine feminine. And then the divine masculine is possible. Then a very nuanced and beautiful alchemy between the two, whether it's portrayed in a relationship or just within oneself, that beautiful harmony, that beautiful balance is possible. But it's originating from, quote unquote, her, from her, because at least in Western thought, you know, and I know this can be different sometimes with Eastern and Western perspective, but at least in Western thought, the feminine is the seat of receptivity and surrendering for the divine winds to move through into external expression. So I wanted to emphasize that because it's sort of on the heels of what we talked about finding one's fire from the Baba Yaga. in our last sessions. And let me just, before we share the poem for today, I wanted to note that in the tarot, which is for me such a beloved system of having archetypal wisdom in our life, you know, people use tarot for many different things and in many different ways. And it can be used very superficially, and it can be used in great depth and in service to understanding archetypes. And I like to think that I use it in the latter sense. But for those of you familiar with the Lover's card in the tarot, in the iconic imagery of the tarot, for the lovers, this is often repeated in whatever deck you find. And that is a masculine and a feminine figure are often represented. And the masculine is looking at the feminine, but the feminine is looking to something otherworldly. It could be an angel, it could be the clouds above, it could be an alchemical reaction of some kind shown in the art on that card. But I feel that that is such an essential and iconic representation of this very thing we're talking about in level four. And that is the right orientation for this most beautiful I am divinity, unity, consciousness of level four is in regards to how it expresses itself in the external world. It is essential that the quote unquote external or masculine force is in service to the being interior feminine that is in touch with the divine. And when that's the case, then all of these are brought to balance. And for me, it's such a beautiful image of how relationship externally can work as well. And it has been my heart's journey to prioritize the divine, the love affair with the divine, so as to experience it in relationship with a human person. And that is so essential to, I know, my learning and growth arc, as it is for many. And, you know, we all have kind of a different flavor of what's bringing us to level four. I know that's mine. And I honor that deeply. It has been very demanding. It has been very challenging. And yet it is also freeing me to myself so that I might have that beautiful external expression, because my priority is first that I am actually meeting God. I have released that in the form of my human beloved. And that can look chaotic until it doesn't. And that's part of it. Now, also, we don't have to hardwire struggle and conflict and, you know, craziness in there with it. We can also, you know, be sensitive and supple with any blocks we're, you know, putting in our own way, any sand we're putting in our own gears there. But there is a certain amount of focus always required to get comfortable with the fact that your authentic self, your essential self, is completely at ease with this sort of dynamic, being basically the open vessel to meet yourself in all the fruits and relationships and wonders of a life beautifully lived on the earth. And I'm about that again. Like, I'm not interested in being in the monastic life, and that is a beautiful journey for some. I think most of us want a beautiful and fruitful engagement with the sensory experience and our earthly walk. But to have that informed by unity consciousness is an entirely different and beautiful, and I would say, I think that is the prodigal return, because anything is possible then. anything is possible because you are dealing with the quantum nature of life and it is assisting you. It is not about you anymore, your egoic human form trying to orchestrate an outcome. You have allied in level four in unity consciousness with all that is. And so in our next podcast for August, I'm going to read another chapter from Autobiography of a Yogi that talks about, once again, what that electric, love, peaceful other side of us is like. Because there's an incredible chapter about Yogananda's ability to, at will, sort of go into that space. And again, I've had level three experiences of that, but I don't know how to sort of activate it on my own in the way that he's going to talk about when we share that next time. But anyway, I just think that's so powerful and an important thing to keep in mind from the 30,000 foot perspective, that any challenge that you're meeting in your earthly walk, if it's taking you to level four, the rewards of that journey are so massively going to outshine any quote-unquote struggle along the way. And that's, we're here to meet ourselves for the first time. So with that, I'd like to end by sharing this incredible poem, On Love, by Rumi. And here we are meeting the Eastern mystical tradition again through this poet. And this is a version by Coleman Barks, and he's a very famous translator of Rumi's work. And this poem is called Buoyancy. And although Rumi had a human beloved, you can tell in this poem that his human beloved experience, relationship, was absolutely penetrated by the light he knew himself to be, the incredible essence, the incredible electric divinity that he accessed in his life that is level four, that is unity consciousness. And that informed this earthly relationship he had. And so it's kind of like, as you read his poetry, you don't know the line between when he's ecstatic about the divine or the human or both. And indeed, he is encountering the divine through the human form, him, his own, and his beloved's. So it's where all of those lines cease to exist. And I can't imagine the joy of that, whether it's in a human relationship, whether it's in a creative pursuit, whether it's in the enthusiasm of a vibrant, healthy body. We can meet God, Goddess, the divine in all of these forms. And that is level four of releasing the form. And that's so extraordinary to me and so worth the discipline of taming the tigers of the mind. So with that, let me read Buoyancy by Rumi. Love has taken away all my practices and filled me with poetry. I tried to keep quietly repeating, no strength but yours, but I couldn't. I had to clap and sing. I used to be respectable and chaste and stable, but who can stand in this strong wind and remember those things? A mountain keeps an echo deep inside itself. That's how I hold your voice. I am scrap wood thrown in your fire and quickly reduced to smoke. I saw you and became empty. This emptiness, more beautiful than existence, it obliterates existence. And yet when it comes, existence thrives and creates more existence. The sky is blue. The world is a blind man squatting on the road. But whoever sees your emptiness sees beyond blue and beyond the blind man. a great soul hides, like Muhammad or Jesus, moving through a crowd in a city where no one knows him. To praise is to praise how one surrenders to the emptiness. To praise the sun is to praise your own eyes. Praise the ocean. What we say? A little ship. So the sea journey goes on, and who knows where. Just to be held by the ocean is the best luck we could have. It's a total waking up. Why should we grieve that we've been sleeping? It doesn't matter how long we've been unconscious. We're groggy, but let the guilt go. Feel the motions of tenderness around you. The buoyancy. I have no other word to offer after that. That is so ecstatic and tender and beautiful and grounding. So we will continue on with another mystical chapter next time. Enjoy the rest of this month, and I'll check in with you before the next full moon. Until next time, take good care. Hi, everyone. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if my work is nourishing your heart and imagination, consider supporting the Apothecary Podcast. Just follow the links to make a contribution. And for the full scope of my projects and offerings, including my weekly newsletter, visit lauriegreen.net.